From the onset of entering the promised land, the people of God struggled.
In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes.
So God raised up judges to help his people stay true to the ways of the Lord.
The last judge was Samuel, who judged Israel all the days of his life.
The people cried out, "Give us a king to judge us like all the nations."
The Lord relented and told Samuel, "Give them their king."
The people chose Saul, a man of good appearance and tall stature, but did not have a heart for God.
The Lord rejected Saul and chose an unlikely candidate in David to be king.
The Lord opposes the proud, exalts the humble, and in spite of evil, his master plan continues to unfold.
This is 1 Samuel.
There is an age-old saying that when I say it, you don't even know what I'm going to say. You're probably going to be able to fill in the blank. It's so easy. It's just like riding a bike. I was really hoping no one said like a story or a book or something like that. But it's so easy. It's just like riding a bike. And you would say that saying a lot of times when it's like, hey, like you're never going to forget it. Like if you learned how to ride a bike at one point, you're always going to know how to ride a bike afterwards. Well, I think that saying is a bunch of hogwash. I rode bike all the time. I learned how to ride a bike at a really young age. And so I stopped riding for whatever reason between the ages of like 10 and 12. And until a few years ago when my friends decided like, hey, we want to start doing some triathlons. And so a buddy of mine gave me one of his bikes, and it's really important for the story that I'm about to share that my friend is 6'3", and the bike that he gave me was too big for me. And so I go to the bike shop to try to help out, and what he told me, he said, man, like when you get to the bottom of the rotation in the pedal, your foot kind of comes off the pedal a little bit. I was like, well, how much money is that going to be? And he was like, $1,000,000. And I was like, looks like I'm going to be uncomfortable when I ride this bike now. And so the first time that we get together to ride, we decided to not ride for 12 minutes. We decided to ride for 12 miles, which I was like, I am actually going to die. And so in the beginning of this bike ride, all of my friends are laughing and, oh, how are the kids doing? And I'm over here on my bike, not talking to anyone, laser focused, because I'm trying not to die. And another thing that you need to know about this bike that I got, this bike of that was a death trap, is it didn't have normal handlebars. It had something called aero bars, which I don't understand why anyone would create a device like this. There's two different ways that you can have your hands. There is these bars that go like this, that you can hold on to this way, or there were some forearm pads that you could put your forearms into and hold on to these little tiny handles. And so at the very beginning, I'm laser focused, only holding on to this, realizing I can't make that transition because my tire is going to do one of these things and I'm going to go forward like this. And so we're riding the bike. I'm finally getting a little more comfortable. I end up making the transition a couple times, and it was Russian roulette every single time that I did that. And then we get to a hill. And this hill was steep. This hill was long. And I decided I'm getting a little cocky. Like, this isn't that hard. It's riding a bike. And so I was like, I'm going to be Lance Armstrong going down this hill. So I put my forearms in the pads, I grab on, and I am ready to go. So we start going down this hill, and we are flying down this hill. We're probably only going like 20 or 30 miles an hour. But when you're going down a hill on a bike, I feel like I'm going the speed of sound. Like, I can't hear anything. I can't see anything. I feel like I'm on a roller coaster. And I realized I'm going a little too fast, though, so I was like, I gotta slow down. And do you know what you use to slow down when you're on a bike? What are they called? Brakes. Well, here's the problem with this death trap of a bike. The position that I'm in doesn't have brakes. The brakes are on the aero bars, which are over here. I'm going too fast to make that transition, so I come to the conclusion, looks like I'm going down this hill with no brakes. Here's the other problem that ended up happening. I'm not pedaling at all. My bike is like pedaling for me, which I didn't know bikes could do that. And my pedals start going wicked fast. I mean, it's like, and what ended up happening is my right foot at the bottom of the rotation came off of the pedal. So now my right foot is off the pedal and my left foot is still pedaling. I'm still here. Eventually, my left foot comes off of the pedal. And I'm just imagining what this is like as like an innocent bystander that's just driving by, seeing nine dudes on a bike going down a hill, like, oh, like, and what you're seeing, and I know it wasn't like this, but it looks like my friends are just like going like in and out. They're like riding backwards down the hill. They're like, riding a bike is so easy. And so you have this idea, these eight guys are super comfortable, and this is exactly what I look like riding my bike. I'm here, my forearms are here, and my legs are like this as I'm flying down this hill. And it's in my, the look that I had on my face was probably one of pure terror as I'm like this. I mean, like, my jaw is clenched, and I'm like, this is the end. This is actually how I die. And the reason I share that with you is I was thinking about that this week. And I thought to myself, following Jesus and trying to be more conformed into the image of God is a lot like riding a bike up a hill. We're either pedaling and going up and to the right and looking more like the people we were created to be, or we aren't pedaling and we're going downhill. There's no staying in the same place. We're either looking more like Jesus and looking more like the image bearers we were created to be, or we're going downhill and not looking like that. And so today we're going to be in 1 Samuel chapter 21 through 23, and what we're going to see with this whole analogy about riding a bike is that the wilderness years are starting to start for David. That last week we talked about the fact that he was inside of the palace and Saul was trying to kill him. And after the 12th time of trying to be killed, David flees. And now David is going to be in the wilderness. And what we are going to see with David is no matter what gets thrown at him, because he is a man after God's own heart, he continues to pedal. He continues to look more like the man that God created him to be because he is a man after God's own heart. But what we are now going to see with Saul is that Saul long ago stopped pedaling. And in the beginning, he started going slow. But now what we're going to see in these stories, like if you thought Saul was going crazy last week, just wait to see what Saul is going to be doing this week. Because what Saul is doing is Saul is going downward and his feet are out and he's leaning forward and he is going at an uncontrollable speed. And so David has just left the palace, and it says this in the beginning of chapter 21. Then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech, which we will call Ahi because his name is repeated a lot in the verses we're going to use, to Ahi the priest. And Ahi came to meet David, trembling, and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" And David said to Ahi the priest, "The king has charged me with the matter and said to me, 'Let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever is here.' And the priest answered David, 'I have no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread if the young men have kept themselves from women.' And David answered the priest, 'Truly, women have been kept from us as always when I go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy even when it is an ordinary journey. How much more today will the vessels be holy?' So the priest gave him the holy bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of presence, which is removed from before the Lord to be replaced by hot bread on the day that it is taken away." Okay, a couple things about this that we need to understand, the context of the situation. One, there's a lot of familiarity here between David and Ahi. Because what David would have done every single time he would have brought his troops into battle is he would have gone to the tabernacle, which we now see is no longer in Shiloh like it was in the beginning of 1 Samuel, but it's actually in the city of Nob, which is in the tribe of Benjamin. And so he would have taken his troops to the high priest, to the tabernacle, so that he could bless him and consecrate his troops so that they can have success within the battle. So Ahi knows David. Like, he's had many conversations with him. So what David just did here would have been very weird for Ahi. Like, first of all, you're by yourself. Where are your troops? Second of all, you've never asked for bread before. So that would have been odd for Ahi. The other thing that we need to understand is what is the bread of presence? He said that there's no ordinary bread, but there's just the bread of presence. What the bread of presence was is inside of the tabernacle and then the temple when it was built, there was a place inside the tabernacle called the holy place, which was right outside the Holy of Holies where the presence of God dwelled. And in the holy place, there was something called the table of showbread. And on this table was bread that they would put out every single day, hot pieces of looked like pita bread that they would put out for the Lord. And what that signified is that God, you are our bread. You are our sustenance. And so every day they would do this to remind themselves that no matter what, God is going to be our provider. God is going to be our sustainer. And when we need something, God is going to provide that for us. And then when it would be removed from there and new cakes or loaves of bread would be brought out, that belonged to the priests. That was their inheritance. That's what they would get. Here's the problem. It doesn't belong to David. David is of the tribe of Judah. He is not a priest. So it was a very weird request for David to ask for this type of bread. So what ends up happening is Ahi ends up giving him the bread. And then in verse 7, there's a very random statement that looks like that's said, but what we're going to see in the narrative of this story, it's not random at all. Now, a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day at the tabernacle, detained before the Lord. Detained before the Lord, we're not sure exactly what that means, but what that probably means is he was worshiping the Lord and was at the tabernacle to worship God. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen. What we need to know here, this guy's going to come up here in the next few minutes. What we need to know here is that he's an Edomite. The Edomites were descendants of Esau, which is one of the sons of Isaac. Jacob and Esau were the twins. And so Esau was not an Israelite. Esau was not a Jew. That's very important for us to know. And so this random, seemingly random Doeg the Edomite is there. And then David asks one more thing from Ahi. He says, do you have any weapons here? Which now if I'm Ahi, I'm like, what's happening? Like you're about to go into war. You don't have any food and you don't have a weapon. Like, aren't you one of the commanders of the army? This is the tabernacle, dude. This isn't a weapons arsenal. Like, but the only thing we have here is the sword of Goliath, the Philistine that you slayed. David says, that'll do. So he takes the bread, he takes this gigantic sword, and he goes on his way. And it says in verse 10 that after that, David rose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. And the servants of Achish said to him, is not this David the king of the land? Did they not sing to one another of him in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. So a more context for us. David leaves the tabernacle and he goes to the city of Gath. The city of Gath is a city of Philistia, which is another name for the Philistines. Does anybody remember what the enemy of Israel was during this time? The Philistines. David was a commander of that army, and he would fight against the Philistines. And not only did he fight against the Philistines, it said that David had success in all of the battles against the Philistines. And I don't know if it's humility or naivety, but David just thinks, no one will know who I am. And he walks into the city, and they're like, isn't that David, the guy that's the king of Israel that like kills all of our people every time we go into battle? But not only did David go to the Philistines, who were the sworn enemies of Israel, acting like no one was going to see him. Does anybody remember the first story of David, the name of the giant that he slayed? Goliath. Does anybody know what city Goliath is from? It's not a trick question. Goliath is from Gath. So David, do you know what? Also, what sword does David have in his hand? Goliath's sword. Like, I feel like David is the kind of friend that, like, his friends are always like, David, I don't really know if I would, like, do that. And David's like, I don't know, we'll see what happens. He goes to the land of the Philistines, who are the sworn enemies of Israel. He walks into the city of Gath, which is the hometown of the giant that he slayed. Goliath's family is probably there, and he's wielding Goliath's sword. And so David gets nervous. David starts fearing for his life. Like, duh, oh, you're going to fear for your life, David. And so what David does is he acts insane. He acts like a madman. And the reason that he did this, especially in the pagan culture back in the day, is they viewed people with mental illnesses as people that either A, had contact with the gods, or B, that were gods themselves. And the reason why we couldn't understand them and they were different than everybody is because it's really hard for us to understand gods. And so it would have been bad karma, bad mojo. It would have been a death sentence for these people to kill David. And so instead of killing David, they just run him out of town. And so David leaves Gath, and it says this in the beginning of 22. And David departed from Gath and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him, and he became a commander over them. And there were with him about 400 men. So it seems people are starting to flock to David. The first people that flock to David are David's family, which kind of makes a lot of sense because if Saul is willing to kill his own family members to get to David, what is he going to be willing to do to David's family members? And so David's family members are not safe, and so they have to flee from Bethlehem. They're also on the run from Saul, and they somehow hear that David is in one of these caves, and they run to him to find protection from David. The other people that seem to be flocking from David, it seems that David is starting to attract a lot of people who are just down on their luck. People who are in distress, people who are in debt. And the thing that I love about this is I think this teaches us a lot about leadership. And it teaches us that David was lowly in spirit, and he led from a place that he was lowly in spirit in. Because people who are low in spirit do well at leading people who are low in spirit. People who are not doing well and people that show their vulnerability are people that want to be led. Like, people want to be led by people like that. And I think that's really important for us to know because all of us in this room are leaders of something. We're leaders of families. We're leaders of our classrooms. We're leaders of our community. We're leaders of our workplace. If you're sitting here in this room, whether this is the first time that you're here or you've been here since the beginning, you are leaders of this church. And I think the temptation that we have as leaders is we have to act like we have everything figured out. We're not allowed to struggle. We're not allowed to bleed. We're not allowed to show insecurity. We're not allowed to show weakness. And if we do that, therefore, that makes us bad leaders. But what we see here is that authenticity breeds authenticity. Vulnerability leads into vulnerability. And genuine leaders are the leaders that are the easiest to follow because they're not acting like somebody that they're not. They're people who are open. They're people who are raw. And people see that and they're led to that. They want to follow that. And that's exactly what's happening here with David. David is low. David is down on his luck. And he's not acting like he has all the answers. He's not acting like everything is okay. And people see that. People are drawn to that. And people want to be led by that. And so David is attracting all of these different people. So then it continues. David's collecting all of these new warriors. In verse 6, it says, "Now Saul heard that David was discovered and the men who were with him. And Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with a spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. And Saul said to his servants who stood about him, 'Hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, that all of you have conspired against me? No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day.' Then comes the random guy from the chapter before. 'Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul, 'I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahi, the son of Ahi, and he inquired of the Lord, And he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent to summon Ahi the priest, the son of Ahi, and all his father's house, the priests who were at Nob, and all of them came to the king. And so Ahi comes to the king. The king is like, why have you rebelled against me? Why have you helped David? Ahi's like, bro, I didn't even know like that stuff was happening. Like, isn't David the commander of your army? Isn't David your son-in-law? Doesn't David live with you? Like, I had no idea that any of this was happening. And Saul says this in verse 16. And the king said to Ahi, you shall surely die, Ahi, you and all your father's house. And the king said to the guard who stood about him, turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand is also with David. And they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me. But the servants of the king would not put their hand to strike the priests of the Lord. Then the king said to Doeg, you turn and strike the priests. And Doeg the Edomite turned and struck down the priests, and he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. In Nob, the city of the priests, he put to the sword both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, and sheep he put to the sword. Bro, Saul's losing his mind. Like, this guy is going downhill fast and out of control. I mean, just think about what happened. Again, I think we read the Bible and we're like, oh yeah, and then 85 priests were slaughtered and murdered, and we turn the page and keep reading. That's a really big deal. Imagine being one of the servants of Saul. You're standing around the king. You're hearing this exchange. You're like, this is kind of weird. Like, shouldn't they be at the tabernacle and not here? Saul starts yelling at him. And then Saul looks at you and says, kill these guys. And what did the servants say? Servants are like, no, I'm not going to kill these guys, which is also a really big deal. Because disobeying the king was a crime punishable by death. So they said, no, we're not going to kill the priests, which meant that they could die themselves. And so then Saul looks at another person who's not an Israelite and says, you slay these people who are innocent that don't have any weapons. And then this guy just goes to town on these people. I mean, just imagine what that's like. Just imagine watching the people who are the most respected, the people who make atonement for the sins of Israel all of the time, people that you love, people that you look up to, are being slaughtered by somebody at the command of the king. Like, you're watching, like, what's happening here is Saul is becoming the very thing that Samuel warned the people against in 1 Samuel chapter 8. He's like, yo, you guys want a king? That's fine. This is something you get to look forward to. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. And in that day, you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. What he's saying, you can have a king, that's fine. He's going to be just like the other kings. He's going to be just like these Gentile kings. And if you remember in 1 Samuel chapter 15, we talked about this a few weeks ago, they fought the Amalekites. And you remember what God told Saul to do. He's like, Saul, I need you to completely destroy these pagan Gentiles. Devote everything to destruction. And we know that Saul was not obedient fully in that. He defeated them somewhat. But he wasn't fully obedient. He wasn't fully faithful to what God called him to do. He kept the king alive. He kept the best of their things to himself. And if you remember, that's the thing that got Samuel out. Samuel's like, I'm done. Like, you're becoming the very thing that I have warned the people against. Flash forward to a few years later. Flash forward to 1 Samuel 22. Now, Saul is standing on top of a hill with a spear, with servants around him who are trembling and are afraid of him. Saul has isolated himself. Saul is angry. Saul is murderous. And he has become the very thing. Not just becoming the very thing. Saul has become the very thing that Samuel warned the people against. Saul is a Gentile king who commanded a Gentile to kill the people of God. In just a few short years, Saul went from not fulfilling the commandment of the Lord completely to becoming the very thing that was fighting against the Lord. Because sin is a slippery slope. Saul is outside the will of God. He's playing the victim instead of saying that he's the cause of all of this. He's not open to criticism or correction. And when we aren't walking with God, it's crazy how quickly we start to slide. Saul is murdering God's priest. God's blessing has been removed from him. And what we are seeing here is the very thing that we talk about all the time here at Fellowship, is that sin takes you further than you want to go, keeps you longer than you want to stay, and costs you more than you want to pay. Saul's not surrounding himself with people who are trying to call him out. Saul's not surrounding himself with people who are open to criticism and helping him become the person that God has created him to be. He is not the leader that David was. He's not vulnerable. He's not authentic. He's not leading from the place that he's at. He's not being genuine. And so people aren't being drawn to that. He's not giving them vineyards so that because he loves them, he goes, hey, there's an open vineyard. He's stealing vineyards from other people so that these servants can do his bidding. He's using it as bait. He's using it as a payment. That's not love. That's not genuine. And so people aren't drawn to that. He's not being held accountable for his action. And he is a man that is sliding downhill fast and is literally willing to kill anybody that gets in his way. And it seems at this point in the story, this is the very middle of this, it's a chiasm, which is just a big literary term for these stories all go together. It's the very middle of this. And it seems that it's very bleak. Like nothing is going to happen from this. Like, how can there be good in all of this? And at the very end of this chapter, we realize that Saul didn't kill every priest. One priest escapes. And his name is Abiathar. And that's going to come into the story here in a minute. And so after Saul kills the priest, they then tell David, behold, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah, which is a city of Israel, and are robbing the threshing floors. What that means is the threshing floors, they did the harvest. They got the grain already, like it's all prepared to cook with. And so what the people would do, what the bigger nations would do, is they would wait for everything to be harvested and made, and then they would come in and steal all of it. They didn't have to do any work. And then the people would have a famine because they didn't have enough food and all their harvest has been taken. So they're stealing from the threshing floors. Therefore, David inquired of the Lord, shall I go and attack these Philistines? And the Lord said to David, go and attack the Philistines and save Keilah. But David's men said to him, behold, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we are to go to Keilah against the army of the Philistines? What David's troops are saying is, hey, David, like, don't you think we have our hands full enough? Like, we're trying to not die from our king and his army. I don't really feel like we should go start other fights. And David goes, you're right. Let me inquire of the Lord one more time. So he inquires of the Lord one more time. And the Lord answered him, arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hand. So they end up fighting against the Philistines. And it says that David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. Now when Abiathar, who's that priest that escaped, the only priest that escaped from the slaughter that Saul had, when Abiathar, the son of Ahi, had fled to David to Keilah, he had come down with an ephod in his hand. Now it was told Saul that David had come to Keilah. And Saul said, God has given him into my hand, for he has shut himself in by entering a town that has gates and bars. And Saul summoned all the people to war to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. David knew that Saul was plotting harm against him, and he said to Abiathar, bring the ephod here. Now, we need to know, we've talked about this multiple times. Everything in Jewish literature is in there for 100% on purpose. There's a reason why something is in there. And so everything seems random. Doeg seemed random. That was just a random sentence in the middle. It was not random. It showed, it led to something. We see then that an ephod gets brought by a priest. What is the significance of that? And what is an ephod? It looks like ephod, but it's ephod. You see, what an ephod was it was the garment that the high priest would wear. It was the high priestly garments. And there's all these different things. There's a big old giddy-up that they would have on. But one of the things that's very significant for this story that was in an ephod was some stones called the Thummim and the Urim. Now, those stones aren't very common to us. What is that? You see, the word Thummim literally means perfection. And what they believed that they did is inside of this apron, there was two Thummim stones. And in those Thummim stones, there was one stone that was white and one stone that was black. And they say perfection because they had to feel the same. They had to look the same. And what they would do is they would choose one of those stones. They'd feel around those two stones and choose one. And then there was a Urim stone, which the whole meaning means light. And in the right lighting, that stone would literally light up. And so what they would do is they would ask a question to the Lord, God, should I have ravioli for dinner tonight? And they would reach in, they would feel for one of the Thummim stones, and then they would reach and feel for the Urim stone, and they would take it out and look at it. Now, if that stone was white and the Urim lit up, that said, the white stone said, yes, you should have ravioli tonight. And the Urim stone lighting up was the affirmation from the Lord saying, I affirm that you should have ravioli tonight. This is why it's significant. In the midst of all of this, in the midst of all the chaos, in the midst of all the movement, what God ends up doing is God ends up giving David access to himself that David didn't have before. And what's happening here in all of these chapters, there's all of these comparisons and contrasts between Saul and David. And what they're trying to show is that Saul is being cursed by God and David is being blessed by God, and they're doing it to show opposites. So what God ends up doing is he shows that Saul's family was running away from him, but David's family was running to him. Saul was killing the priesthood, but David was saving it. Saul lost his access to God by killing all of the priests, but David gained access to God. Saul was losing people in his army, and David was gaining people in his army. Saul was responsible for an entire city being destroyed, the city of Nob. David was found saving an entire city of Keilah. There's these comparisons. There's these contrasts. God is blessing David. God is cursing Saul. And what's happening here is what we see is the minute that David gets access to the Lord, the minute that David gets the ephod, we see in chapter 23, he inquires of the Lord four times. Because not only did David get access to God, David was excited to have access to God, and David used his access to God because David was desperate for God. And what we see in this story is David is surrounding himself with community. David is surrounding himself with people that are going to call him out and hold him accountable. He's leading in vulnerability. He's having access to God and using access to God. And what's happening is David is climbing up this hill. He's pedaling up this hill. He is looking more like Jesus. And Saul, since the beginning of his reign, he had unlimited access to God. He had hundreds of priests with all these Urim and Thummim, and he very rarely, if seldom, got access to God and went into the throne room to ask God what he thinks that he should do, which led to his ultimate demise as a person that's going down the hill with his legs spread wide, that's completely out of control. And that's us, man. Like, we need to understand, like, following Jesus is not just a one-time thing. It's not just a season. And, like, we can't just be in community and confess and be vulnerable, and we do that for a few months, and that just becomes who we are. And that's an every second of every day kind of choice. Like, that's something that we choose to be every single day. And when we're in the wilderness, when we're in the position that David's in, it feels like when we're pedaling that that incline just continues to ramp up. It continues to get harder. It continues to get more difficult. But what we see in this story is in the wilderness, we realize that it was never our strength that got us up the hill. It's in the wilderness that we realize we can't pedal on our own. We need God. We need his strength to keep pedaling. And we not only need the strength of God to keep pedaling, we need the wisdom of God so he can show us in what direction he wants us to go. It's in the wilderness that if we are committed to following Jesus, that trust deepens in our God, and desperation for God to move is the fuel that keeps us going. When times get tough, our motivations get brought into the light. There's a woman that wrote an article in Desiring God, and in this article, she talks about this wilderness. And in the wilderness, she didn't find any answers, but what she found was intimacy with her Creator. And what she said is, she said this, "Intimacy with God is more important than my sense of calling from God. That when he calls us to wait, he is drawing us closer to himself." It reveals our motivations. So are we more concerned about answers and being used by God and for powerful things of God? And that's why I'm so glad that Andrew did what he did here with the prayer. Like, we pray all of these supernatural things. We want revival. We want great things. We want God to move in our church. But the way that God does that is he does it through individual people. A lot of times revival is not this huge forest fire that comes out of nowhere. A lot of times revival starts with a little bit of stirring within the coals, and it gets a little hotter and a little hotter and a little hotter. And then when one person starts to get excited by God, another person gets excited, and then another person gets excited, and it takes weeks and months and years, and then eventually we have this forest fire, but it starts with a stirring in the coals. It starts when we're in the wilderness and we say, I don't want to have to pedal hard, but I'm going to pedal hard because I want intimacy with my Jesus. I want intimacy with my God. I want to look more like him. Let's take it home. How many of you, I'll ask it this way, and I know this is going to be vulnerable, and I'm going to ask you to raise your hand. How many of you would say that you're in the wilderness right now? You can raise it. People in the tech booth. It's okay. Put your hands down. How many of you would say that you have been in the wilderness, but you got out? Raise them high. Be proud of it. You were in the wilderness, and God rescued you from that. I want you to look around the room. Keep them high. If you are in the wilderness right now, I want you to look at that. I mean, my hand is up all over the place. And I'll tell you, it wasn't fun. You can put your hands down. But that whole idea of intimacy is so true. And so what we have to ask ourselves is going and riding our bike is not fun. The wilderness is not fun. But the thing that we have to ask ourselves is, are we going to surround ourselves with a group of people that we're authentic with? Because that's not what Saul had. You see, that story, I have an ending to it. I didn't die and I didn't eat pavement. As I'm going crazy down this hill, my legs are out, I'm shaking. One of my buddies rides up next to me, probably seeing the distress on my face, and he says, "Hey, you know you can adjust your gears, right?" So I adjust the gears, the pedals slow down, I finally am able to get the aero bars and brake. I mean, honestly, if it wasn't for my friend coming next to me, it would have been tough. I would have probably been to the hospital that night. But that's what community is. My buddy Bear was over at my house the other night. It was a tough night for me, and he just showed up at my house, which is, all of us need friends like that. And we were talking about something, and I was like, man, I just don't ever want to be like this. Like, it was just talking about a fear that I had of becoming something I don't want to be. And he's like, nah, dude, you're not going to be like that. I was like, what makes you say that? And he said, because if you even start becoming like that, I'm going to show up at your house like I did tonight, and I'm going to beat you up. And he was kidding, and I would beat him up any day. But that's community. That's vulnerability. And that's what Saul didn't have, and that's what David did have. And so the thing that keeps us going up and to the right is the power of God. And one of the powerful things that God gives us is community to keep pedaling. And one of the things God gives us too is people that go down the hill with us and say, hey, you're going a little out of control. Can I help? And so are we going to be people that pedal no matter how hard it gets, relying on the power of God? Or are we going to be people that skyrocket downward? If you are feeling like you're in this room and your life feels like this right now, like, I want to let you know that's okay. The God of the universe is not mad. He's not disappointed. The God of the universe doesn't want you to be in this position, though, because he loves, not because he's a condemning, only judgmental God. He is a loving and merciful God, too, and he wants to save us from smashing our teeth into some concrete. And so if that's you and you are in a downfall, man, we're going to have some elders up here. I will be up here. We want to talk to you. Bring people into that. Be vulnerable within that. But we have communion here on both sides. It's a really important thing for us to take just as a body of believers. And again, we're going to keep this place as reverent if we can keep our lights like this. If you want to visit, we have a great lobby, huge lobby for you to do that in. But keep this place reverent for that. But you guys know what to do now. Go love first. We love because he first loved us. Have a great week of worship fellowship.